Welcome, welcome, my friends, to the Beggars and Brawlers podcast. This is episode 70, recorded Tuesday, the 28th of November, 2023. And I have another chapter for you today in our Queen of Blood and Blasphemy preview, chapter 2. Plus, a little talk afterwards about what to do when your dead body is a dead city. Okay, so before we get started, just a quick spoiler warning that this is chapter 2 of the book, so listen to chapter 1 first. But more importantly, if you haven't read book 3 or book 2, this is book 4, or book 1 for that matter, this will spoil them heavily. So make sure to read those first. And if you haven't, there are preview series of those books too earlier on in the podcast feed, so go check those out. But if you're all caught up, without further ado, I give you chapter 2 of Queen of Blood and Blasphemy.
The debris only thickens as we pull into the bay, houses and fencing mixed with barrels of wine and bales of smoke tea. Whatever it was clearly hit the city's dockside warehouses. Dito is the closest independent port to Saray, which is why we'd been coming here in the first place, to resupply and gather information without drawing attention. Looks like we'll be the least of the news. We stick to the plan, I say to my friends, all of us gathered at the foredeck, as Isong relays steering directions through Astrija, and we dodge the worst of a city turned to shipwreck. Astrija, Begdil, Isong, you get off and gather information while you trade for supplies. Could just fish for him, Anon drawls, nodding at the wreckage in the harbor. Anon, Astrija scolds, but I know my friend well enough to see humor is just his way of dealing with it. Like Teiwo has gone quiet and Isong strictly rational. And me? I take a breath, sorting it out. I should feel panicked or maybe defeated, but somehow seeing this, seeing the floods actually happening is reassuring. Like I've spent so long thinking about this moment, fearing it, trying to prevent it, that at least now I can let go of that. The floods are here, they're real, whatever that means. We're not crazy, and my father wasn't crazy to think they were coming soon. Now we just have to do what we can. And that's where the strap of worry comes in, ratcheting tighter around my chest. I have been doing what I can, and it hasn't been enough. I duck below decks as Isong gives Astrija final guidance into port. This is part of the plan, too. If our goal is not to draw attention, the last thing people in a port half a day's sail from Saray need to see is a girl with violet eyes, even if I'm not wearing Ujian robes. I also don't need to be there, because I have combination blood and water sight. I settle into one of the bunk rooms Akifte and I were attacking only a week ago, finding my breath and focus, and letting it sink as deeply into my mind as my body, in a blending of monk and therapeutic meditations. I can't help thinking, as I do, of my lover bound to a bed in the next bunk room over. I hate keeping her there, but Miara refuses to release her blood push, and I don't trust the woman nearly enough to let her have eyes and ears in my team. Even if it means Gaxana is still a prisoner, and I spend even less time with her than I did on the road. I hate it. I hate Miara for it even more, and I especially hate that I need the woman too much to just slip into Saray and kill her, even if that would free Gaxana. Miara knows where a monocle is in the Daol. She is an inside ally against Nerimace and Yeolat if we need to take action in Saray. And she controls the entire Sarayan Guild of Therakins, a powerful force if I can convince her to ally the guild with me, and a powerful enemy if not. I need her for all that, and because she understands hierarchism, is a hierarchist, like all my enemies. If I ever want to defeat them, if I'm ever going to break through that impossible wall keeping me from Nerimace, I need to know what she knows. And so my lover lies bound in the next room. And so my heart feels incomplete, even though I finally let Isong in. And so I once again hate myself for choosing my mission over my love, even if I would do it all over again, even if I keep making that decision every moment I don't drop everything to go hunt Miara down. Soon, I send through the bond to Gaxana, as I so often do, even if all I find on the far side is the blankness of a bloodborn. I want to believe, somewhere in there, that she can hear me. As soon as I've gotten the monocle, as soon as I make sure we're not all going to die, then it's your turn. Promise. For now, I need to find out what happened in Jateau so we can make a plan. If it's one of my enemies, this means they've not only found a monocle, but a way to control it. The thought makes me sick. Still, it would give me a goal too, a person to track down and kill, and a clearer path to getting a monocle than I've ever had. If it's not one of my enemies, if it's not one of them, it must be my God. The thought hollows me out like a rat in a ripe melon. I roll my shoulders, trying to let the feeling pass. I can't think about that one right now. Information first. I gather my concentration and push it through the bond to Isong. His consciousness blooms in my awareness, overwhelming me with sensation. The creak of the plank as he follows Begdil onto the stone dock. The ache in his chest from his still healing arrow wound. The smell of smoke on the air, and the awful sight rising behind a handful of people gathering at the end of the stone dock. An entire city erased to 50 feet above the water's edge. What was once surely a thicket of wood houses and cobbled streets, now a bare mud slope strewn with debris, like some giant mason rammed his trowel into the city halfway up and scraped everything below it out to sea. No, that last thought was Isong's, part of the deluge of theories and notions streaming from his mind as his perceptions stream through the blood. There's just so much coming through the bond, now that my sight is both blood and water, that I sometimes feel like a new swimmer cast into a rain-swollen river, struggling to stay upright. Isong's mind is particularly hard for me, because his thoughts come fast and sharp as knives. Anand's is slower, if no less perceptive, and Tewo is actually kind of relaxing to inhabit, but Isong is what I need right now, to help me catch every nuance of what's going on, because the people waiting at the end of the dock don't look happy. I notice, in a flash of tightness through the abdomen that I'm not sure was his or mine, that they're armed. The man in front carries a hefty knife, blade bare, and two or three of the men and women behind him clutch spears and swords, though none look particularly comfortable doing it. "Is of Ujay," Begdil says in his grave tone, approaching them first. Jateau is not formally a vassal of Saray or its faith, but leading with a monk still seemed like the best move, especially when we arrived in Adale Clipper, symbol of the people who have slowly drained wealth and trade from ports like this, concentrating their growing merchant influence on the larger ports. "What's your business here, monk?" the man with the knife asks in cold tones. "Come to check your god's handiwork?" "And what's with the ship?" a woman with sodden hair asks behind him, eyes rimmed red. "Or have you so openly sold your faith to the Frost Eyes that you sail in their ships now, too?"
"Peace," Begdil says again. "We have nothing to do with what happened here, and have only learned of it as we sailed in. Have faith in Ujay, brother. He would not allow this to happen."
"Have you not brought supplies, then?" a thinner man calls from the pack behind. "Aid for us and ours. I lost my wife and half my family in that flood, and the house we slept in."
His eyes are as hollow as the woman next to him, and my heart twists as I, or Isong, notice the arm not holding a spear, clutches a small child to his side. Isong lets out a groan, and I realize I am letting too much of my emotion back through the bond to him, too much of the pain I feel for this man, and the fear behind it, the fear that this is only the beginning. "We'll figure this out, Alethea," Isong says in a thought clearly meant for me, and I take reassurance from his confidence in the bond. "Trust me." "You're hurt," Estrija says to the man in front, and though I struggle to stay afloat in the river of Isong's consciousness, I also get a taste of her concern coming through the bond with her. The more we connect, the more I realize the woman has a heart of gold, no matter how sharp her tongue can be. No wonder Gaxna loved her. "Stay back, witch," the man barks, leveling the knife at her approach. "We need none of your kind here."
"Please," she says, spreading her hands. "I am a healer. I can help you. See to your wounded."
"Will you see to my husband, face down out there in the waves?" the sodden-haired woman snaps. "Or to my 5 cousins, caught trying to unload their catch when the waves came in? Can you bring back my eldest boy, who swam out there trying to help them and hasn't come back in?"
"Did the water come all at once, then?" Isong asks. And I can feel his earnestness in wanting to know what happened, even as I know it's the wrong thing to say.
"You tell me, Frost Eyes," the woman spits, turning to him. "Likely your craftology that did it, isn't it? Got Saray and all these in your pocket.
She waves a hand at Estrija and Begdil. And now you come to see whether you can flood the rest of us? Well, it didn't work. We're still here.
She levels her spear, and her red-rimmed eyes go dark.
Now leave us to it. We've got enough to do without your help.
Please, Estrija tries again. We are not from Saray. We're the ones who left months ago, who disagreed with the Dale coming in, with the leadership in the temple and guild. Isong is a dissident, exiled from their lands. We want to help you and to understand what happened here, to stop it from happening again.
Prove it, the man in front says, his voice cold. If you're of the old faith, the real faith, and not these snakes they've got running Saray now, prove it, or we'll have you off our dock one way or another.
Uncertainty rolls through Isong's bond, echoed in Estrija and Begdil, but I don't wait to see what they say. It won't matter. These people need something more than words. I burst out of the lower bunk and up the stairs, running toward the dock. To the depths with secrecy. They deserve better. Here, I say, running down the plank and meeting their eyes with my violet ones. Am I proof enough? I am Sturgjon's daughter, Alethea Viola, the one Nerimes tried to kill. The girl with the man's powers. A heresy, the Saray Temple calls me, though my father never thought so. Come. I hold out my hand. I can read your waters if you need proof. No other woman could do that. That's not technically true anymore, but we don't need details here. We need trust. The man eyes my hand without lowering his weapon. And you travel with a frost eyes and a witch in addition to this monk? He gestures at Begdil with a knife, who spreads his feet in Wind Carry's wave stance. No, this cannot come to a fight. Not least of all because we need to understand what happened here, and because these people have had trouble enough already. I travel with anyone loyal to my cause, I say, leaving my hand extended. This Frost Eyes has saved my life more times than I can count, and this witch betrayed her own oaths to fight the floods when she saw they were wrong. I was raised to see them both as enemies, and that is part of the poison that's spreading in Saray. I've learned to see past it. The leader flexes his chin, though the red-eyed woman behind him still holds her spear at the ready. The man with the child steps forward. I'll take your test. He seizes my hand with his, rough and calloused. What am I thinking? Of course, I see so much more than what he's thinking. I feel the exhaustion in his body, sense the grief he has shoved into the recesses of his heart, and read the bone-deep worry he has about where he will live and how he will care for his child. My heart breaks in an instant. If Isong's consciousness was a stream of sharp-edged thoughts, this man, Jung's, is a lava flow of pain and loss. I drag in a breath, pulling myself back from the bond. A red-winged blackbird, I say, my voice unsteady. I meet Jung's eyes and hope he sees something more than another threat in mine. You were thinking of a red-winged blackbird. I was, he says, sounding odd despite the situation. He steps back and pulls his child to his chest. The lead man glances at Jung, then drops his weapon. Perhaps you are what you say you are, then. But you've just happened to come now, less than a day after we get flooded? Yes, I say, holding back the questions I'm burning to ask, that I can feel on Isong and Estrija's tongues, too. Trust first, then questions. We had no idea what had happened here until we saw the debris in the water. We are freshly come from Sarante and out of touch with the news. Sarante, he grunts, and strangely this seems to be the thing that fully convinces him as he puts his knife back and glances at the others, who put up their weapons. What in deeps were you doing there? The same as we do here, I say, relief loosening the knot in my chest. At least this won't be a fight. Searching for answers. Until our enemies came to besiege us. We escaped using their ship. Surprise registers on their faces, looking back at the sleek Dale ship. Now that I think about it, Isong says, before they can react, there may be a connection between that and this. If it was our enemies who caused this flood, they may have guessed we were coming here, tried to time it to wreck us in port. The red-eyed woman sucks in a breath, gaze darkening. So you're the ones who brought this on, and we're just the collateral loss of their attack? I wouldn't put it past them, I say, but we don't know for sure. If you could tell us more about how it happened. It wasn't your enemies, Jung says quietly, shaking his head. There isn't anyone in this world who could do this, and we all know that. Know what it has to be.
They can, Estrija protests. We've seen it in our visions. The monks have too. That's what we were seeking in Sorante, a tool to control the floods, to stop them. The same tool that, in the wrong hands, could cause them. Jung nods, but the cast to his eyes doesn't change. I don't need the bond to know what he's feeling, because I feel it too. The gutted sensation I first felt in Sorante, wondering if it might be Ujjayi who's doing this. Whether we've been found wanting, as so many civilizations have before us. Whether it isn't just our time. So we have a few questions, Isong says, if you don't mind, to try to understand who might have done this. What difference does it make? The red-eyed woman asks. It's done. It won't help you, Estrija says, and I switch to the bond with her because I could use some of the passion I hear in her voice. But the difference is that we can stop the next one if we find out who caused this. Stop them from attacking another city or coming back for the upper part of yours. I take a steadying breath, feeling the determination in her, and pull myself back from that hollowing doubt. Yes, we can do this. We can stop Narimes or Yaelat if they're the ones behind it. And if it's my god instead, the chronicles say we can stop that too. How did the waters come? Isong asks. Was it gradual or all at once? A tidal wave? Tide just didn't stop coming in, the headman says. Looked like a king tide at first, but then it just kept coming. First over the piers and then up the streets, and all the while the sun's shining and the sky's clear as a bell. We managed to untie most of the boats, get people moving uphill. Then the water stopped and... He chokes, and the woman behind him continues, her voice cold. And then it went out, all at once, like we were in a tipped pan of water and somebody set it right again. Ripped the houses right off the streets, and the ships, and everybody with more than a foot in the water. You can see how it went out, there and there, she says, pointing at the slopes of the bay to either side, where a rising line of debris and bare earth marks the wave that passed. Like a tidal wave going out. So I don't know if you think that's natural, or something your monks did up in the temple, or some kind of punishment your god's putting on us, the headman says, but we can't stay. Not with our boats gone, and the bay ruined, and those waves ready to come back any time. He looks past me, at the open water beyond the ship, and for the first time I see emotion behind his stoicism. Fear. I can't, anyway. I'm taking mine and everyone who wants to come and moving up higher. Others nod behind him, and I don't know what's worse. Not being able to reassure them the waters won't come back, or the defeated look on the faces of the people picking through the mud behind them, like it doesn't matter if the waters come or not, that their world has already ended. We will stop this, I say, meeting Jung's eyes. Whether it's God or man or something else, we will stop it. Thank you for trusting us with your story. I'm sorry we can't do more to help. We have gunpowder to trade, at least, Isong says, in case you have goods to sell, at whatever rate. The headman just laughs, nodding out at the sea. It's all out there. Nothing to sell you. An idea comes to me. We have money, too. Ravas from Duran. Vital ravas. 50 coins on the neck of anyone wounded will speed their healing and lend strength to anyone else. Worth more than their weight in gold if you need to sell them. They will help you rebuild. I focus inside, calling one of the sailors to bring up coins. We still have most of the bull's 40,000, so I ask him to bring 10,000, a fortune in the arena, and hopefully enough to make a difference to these people. I wish I could do more, but we have our own battle to fight. You can do this, I say, reaching out my hands on impulse. You can survive this. We can, together. We've done it after every flood they've ever sent to us, and we'll do it again now. The headman considers for a moment, then takes my hands, followed by Jung and the red-eyed woman and the three others who have been silent watchers. It would be overwhelming, the flood of fears and doubts and pain I feel in their bond, but for once I don't focus on what I see in the bond, but what I can bring to it. My hope for stopping the floods, no matter where they're coming from. The trust I have in my friends to help me do it. The determination I feel in all their hearts through the bond. I pull all that in through our bonds, then push it out through the hands clasping mine, into the hearts of these people who have lost everything. Their faces clear a little, and I feel a small echo of hope return in the bond. It may not be much, but at least I've done something to help. Now to do the rest.
Okay, so I hope you enjoyed that. I wanted to talk some now about what to do when your dead body is a dead city, because obviously in this chapter, we have a dead city, the city of Jito, and people who've been affected by it. And it might, that title might not make sense unless you're much of a murder reader, but murder mysteries almost always open with a dead body. And from there, the detective starts to search for who did the body and find out all kinds of things. But you'll notice that especially CSI or like these TV shows where the time is really compressed and they have to tell you a whole story in half an hour, the first scene's going to have a dead body or somebody saying, hey, there's a dead body, and they go to see it. And the story starts from there. That is not generally how fantasy stories start. We usually do something else. But I felt it was the right opening for this book because this book, being the culmination of a lot of things, is also the culmination of the mystery that's been hanging over our heads from the beginning of the series. That is, when are the floods coming? Well, first it was if the floods are coming, and then, okay, they're coming, and then when are they coming? And the last two books has kind of been, how do we actually stop them once they come? But mostly we've been wondering, how much time do we have? It was a big issue in the last one, still a big issue in this one, but I wanted to start it off with a warning shot over the bow of, you don't have much time at all because this thing happened. So that's more of a fantasy opening of time is running out, but this is also a mystery opening of, how did this happen? And we see her questioning even in this chapter, and it's questioning that goes on and gets more intense throughout the book of, who did this? Was this one of my enemies who's managed to weaponize the monocle? In which case, I have options and I can go fight them. Or was this the beginning of their actual flood, something that Alethea believes is sent by God? And if that's the case, what is to be done? Can I fight God? Have we been judged unworthy and nothing I do matters because it already hasn't been enough? And I didn't necessarily plan it that way, but that ended up being her personal arc for this book, not to give spoilers away, is struggling with that question. And finally, with the answers that she gets, which are not the ones she expected and not an easy yes or no, like we might think of right now. But I also wanted this opening just because I wanted to deal more deeply with the mystery of who did it. But it's kind of fitting that in a mystery novel, it's going to be a body or maybe a string of bodies if you have a serial killer. But in an epic fantasy, it's going to be the fate of the world that's at stake. That's always what we do. And so I had to have a lot more bodies, even if we don't really see them, except for that bloated pig. There are a lot more bodies. And so it's a whodunit on the world scale, which was a lot of fun. And I realized just now, actually, in reflecting on it, that it's really fitting that I start off that way because this entire series has been a series of mysteries in a way that my first series, The Empire of Resonance, was not. That series was, you know, just kind of a straightforward epic fantasy where people are in danger and we have to defeat the thing who's in danger. That's kind of the opening thing that hooks you in. And of course, it gets more complicated from there. But in thinking back on this series, we open on her reflecting on a dead body, which is her dad, and the mystery of book one is who killed her father. The mystery of book two is probably the least mystery-esque. She's wondering, how did my father's killer get the power that he has? And of course, how does she get out of the arena without capitulating to those enemies? Book three, Rebel of Riddle and Woe, is very directly a mystery of what is the solution to the floods that my father thought was there, sorting it out from the text and also from her experiences and talking to people. And of course, wondering, when is it coming? How much time do we have? And where is the solution, the thing that they find, which I guess I can say here is the monocle because we're doing spoilers. But so it's kind of interesting. Book one asks who, and book two asks how, and then book three asks what and where. So I guess book four should be asking why. I didn't think this through. This is something, a lot of times, I only realize the structure of the things I've written after I'm done writing them. But if I had known that the central question of this book should have been why, I think I could have written more to that. But there is some why in there of why are the floods happening. Actually, now that I think about it, all of the main characters in this book give their opinion of why. And they're all just opinions, even one of them who's really in the know, because no one really knows. No one's lived through it, except for maybe one character that you'll meet. But there's a lot of struggling over why, as well as the who of who did this to Jito. So, yeah, I guess I cover all five basic questions in the course of the series, so it must be a complete series. I have really enjoyed writing books in this way, where we start off with a mystery. In writing the last series, where I needed to start off with a new danger, it always felt a little flat to me. I mean, of course you care about the characters, and if they're in danger, you want them to be safe. But if you start four books off with that same opening, kind of feels like beating someone over the head or like repeating the same format. This series did not feel like the same opening to me, despite these all essentially being mysteries, with maybe the exception of number two, which is more of a MacGyver mystery of how. It didn't feel repetitive in that way, but I think I love it more because that danger opening also has to start you at a certain stake level, and a book gets more interesting if the stakes raise. If we start off, you know, like book one starts off with who killed my dad, and then it becomes a, ooh, I think it might be this guy. And then, ooh, they're going to try to kill me too. And then, ooh, this plot of how they killed him extends a lot further. And I'm in love with someone. So now I have the higher stakes of this person is in danger. You know, if you start off at a 9, you don't have very many places to go. But if you start off with an opening of danger that's at a 2, we don't really care. It's like, somebody threw a rock at me. Oh, no, we have to go find them. That's not very interesting. So the danger opening can fall flat, I think, in a way that the mystery, it promises you what the book is going to be about. And it can be intriguing in a way that allows for more things to develop and for danger stakes and other stakes to raise without kind of starting at a 5 or 6 and not having that many places to go dynamically within the story. So all that to say, I think that I will probably be a mystery writer from now on. Not that my books will maybe ever be like primarily mystery versus fantasy genre. Like, I think the thing that I'll always care about more is the epic fantasy, like world is at stake or magic matters to the plot or whatever you want to point to as being the real heart of fantasy. I think that is still always the heart for me. And I think that partially just because those are the stories I love reading versus I read widely, but the other stories don't hold me and don't call me back the way that epic fantasy does. So I think that's what I should probably write too. And I guess in thinking about this whole series being a mystery and in thinking about starting off with a dead body or a dead city in this case, I think kind of hanging over our head and a reason that this might be a mystery is that we've had this dead civilization lurking in the background of this series from the start. From the Fist of Ujjayi that's sticking up out of the waters in book one that I honestly just randomly put in. I think I knew the world was post-apocalyptic, but I didn't know much more than that. And then, you know, we're inside a tower that was built by a previous civilization in book two. And in book three, as we travel, we see all these strange ruins and end up in, you know, like, I don't know if I've said this publicly before, but the end of book three is set in a series of skyscrapers that are sticking out of the water. So the dead body of a previous civilization has always been hanging over our heads. And no one in this world really understands how it happened or why it happened or especially how to stop it. So maybe it makes sense that those are all mysteries and that this book, which has to tie it up, opens with the dead body on a larger scale instead of just her father. It is kind of echoing the dead body of that civilization, but it's the beginning of the dead body of this civilization and all the questions that it raises. And I wish that I had thought about this more as I was writing it. Not that I'm going to go back because it's revised and polished and I am done, my friends, but there is actually literally the dead body of a civilization in this book. And if you've read the novella Thief of Smoke and Sorrow, you'll know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, you'll find out when you read the book. I don't think it'll come out in these preview chapters, but I actually literally have one in here. So yeah, it's really interesting to me always to see in retrospect how things line up that I did not consciously think of or plan, but that either were a lucky happenstance or maybe a logical outcome or just a deeper story brain working and pushing me around and me just being flexible enough to do it, which is something that I'm learning over time. But it's pretty interesting. So I hope you enjoyed seeing the dead body at the open of this book. I think there's always a macabre pleasure in that. And I hope that you enjoy finding out more about that dead body as the book goes on. I'll have another preview chapter for you in a couple days, or already if it's in the feed. And this one is going to talk about what to do with old characters, because after four books, you get some characters who've been through a lot, and you know, what do you do with them after they've learned everything and leveled up to be superhumans or whatever? So we're going to talk about that. And then the one after that for chapter four, we'll talk about the very strange point of view that you'll see in next time's chapter, chapter three, using her combination of powers. Something very strange that I tried for this series that I've never done before and absolutely loved. And then our last preview, chapter five, we'll talk about fulfilling the promises that I set out in the very beginning, like that dead body sticking out of the water of a previous civilization. So there's lots to look forward to. Thank you for listening, especially to me rambling at the end. I'm still flabbergasted that anyone cares. And so I'll have another preview for in a couple days. Until then, as always, hope this podcast finds you well and in the company of good books.
For more information on Levi Jacobs and his books, including the award-winning Tide Collar Chronicles, visit www.levijacobs.com. Or for a free audiobook, only available to podcast listeners, go to www.levijacobs.com/free. Thanks for listening, and read on.